Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 21st of September. How would you like to be interviewed at the age of 114 like that? He sounded marvelous, didn't he? Woo! 114. I guess I'm glad maybe he didn't serve in World War I because he was could live longer to let us know what we need to do to be happier with change. All right, this hour of the program, this is a fascinating story. The book is The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs, and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption. Jim Gorant is the author of the book. He has worked as a magazine editor and writer for 20 years and is currently a senior editor at Sports Illustrated. He is the author of The Fanatic, 10 Things All Sports Fans Should Do Before They Die. And his work has appeared in Men's Journal, GQ, and Outside. He details the raid on Michael Vick's farm and then spends a great deal of the book looking at the rehabilitation of the dogs, the placement of the dogs that were rescued from this farm. He also tells a detailed story of how complicated it was to nail this story, how everybody wasn't cooperating with each other to make sure that justice was served. You'll recall this story. In July of 2007, Michael Vick and three other men were arrested and charged with operating an interstate dogfighting ring. The authorities took 51 pit bulls from his Virginia fighting compound, which he had called the Bad News NEWZ Kennels. And the book also details, which is hard to read, how the dogs had been abused and many of the dogs had been tortured. But the story of redemption then is how these dogs found new lives as pets, and several of them, you got to love this story, are now therapy dogs, which is just wonderful. Jim is joining us. We will also be speaking later in the program with Brandon Bond, who's the adopter of Machiavelli Mac, one of the dogs, and Martina McClay, who adopted Leo, and Leo is now a certified therapy dog. So we'll be having the chance to hear about their adoptions as the hour progresses. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Jim. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Yeah. The picture that's on the cover of the book was also on the cover of Sports Illustrated, wasn't it?
That's right.
We're going to put this on our Facebook. I forgot to tell you, so they can see this dog. Tell me about this dog, who this dog is.
That's Sweet Jasmine. She's one of the 51 pit bulls rescued from Michael Vick's property. And she's one of the dogs, you know, the book goes in sections, but at the end, like you mentioned, it follows five or six dogs in particular and sort of really details their rehabilitation. And she's one of the five that I spent a lot of time on, and just a really interesting and sweet dog.
How difficult was it for you to get Newsweek to make a big to let you do a big story on this? It was sort of branching outside the realm of football and baseball and basketball.
Right. I mean, you know, when I first stumbled across the story, I thought it was really interesting, and I just had a lot of curiosity about, you know, what it all meant and how it all worked and what had been going on behind the scenes with all these dogs, and it just seemed like there was a lot of fascinating material there. But I said to myself, well, you know, it's probably too distant a connection to sports for Sports Illustrated, and I just sort of put it aside, and I did that a few times. I would go back, and then finally I made a few calls, and I got a little more information, and I just thought, you know, it's so interesting, I have to give it a shot. So, you know, I wrote up a proposal, and I pitched it to my bosses there at Sports Illustrated, and to their credit, they thought it was a great story, too, so we went with it.
Were you a dog lover before this?
You know, I yes. You know,
yes, you were.
That's a hard answer, you know, because dog lover means a certain thing, you know what I mean? Like, I'm a person who loves dogs. I grew up with dogs. I don't have one currently. But a dog lover, I think of as people with, like, bumper stickers about their dogs, and, like, they're really all about their dogs. You know,
right.
Those are dog lovers, so
right.
Probably
I
not
see.
In that category. But I'm a guy who has a great appreciation for dogs, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I'm surprised you don't have one of these dogs, Jim. Why not?
You know, I don't. I don't know why not. We, you know, up till now, we haven't we had a cat that passed a number of years ago, right about when my children were born. So we went from that right into the infant years, and just seemed like, you know, a dog was adding to the craziness. But just in the last 2 years or so, we've really been considering it. We've actually been looking for a dog. But the reason we're not looking for a pit bull is because they're just, they're high energy dogs. They need a lot of exercise and a lot of time. And we have a dual working family with kids in school and doing lots of sports and stuff. So I just don't think it would be fair to that kind of a dog to bring it into our house. But I wouldn't be afraid to. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. And a lot of people have said what you've done for pit bulls here. It is amazing to me, getting to the end of the story first, which we shouldn't. We'll get to the beginning in a moment. But so many of these dogs, not so many, but a substantial number, have become therapy dogs, which totally alters our image of pit bulls.
Yeah, that was one of the eye-openers for me, too. Going into it, you know, I didn't know a lot about pit bulls myself, you know, just what you hear about them. I had never really met one up close. I just didn't know, and for me, that was a huge sort of educational part of it, and it was great to be able to sort of detail that in The Lost Dogs, you know, to bring all that out and sort of delve into the history of the breed and how it was developed and what the real attributes of it are and you know, how it is potentially and often a sweet, great family dog. It's just a matter of socializing it properly and training it properly and, you know, and managing it properly.
You talk about Vix having had a pit bull as a pet and was a sweet dog, a companion to him. I am interested in, and you write about this, the psychology of people who become dog fighters. 40,000 dog fighters in this country. Is it an extension of their masculinity, or what in the world is going on? Why would you do this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's all conjecture a little bit because, you know, not being a dog fighter and not seeing the appeal of it at all, it's hard for me to say specifically. But, you know, there, when you talk to people who have studied it, there's a couple of things going on there. And one of them is, yeah, an extension of your own sort of whatever it is, machismo, masculinity, or just, you know, you're trying to project a certain image of yourself and the dog embodies that image, you know. Another part of it is there's, and this extends to a lot of other things that people do, but there's this sense of, I guess I'll call it playing God for a sense, you know, that you're creating this. You've bred this dog, you've raised it a certain way, you've trained it, and when it becomes this successful, you know, at doing what it does in the pit against other dogs, you know, that's sort of an extension of you, and it's a credit to your ability to, you know, spot the right dogs, to raise it a certain way. And so in a way, it's like, you know, training a thoroughbred. You know, when a horse wins the Kentucky Derby, we all credit the trainer, you know, and the breeder, you know. And so with these dogs, they look at it, there's a similar thing there. And so I think for some people, that's part of the appeal, this idea of sort of being able to manipulate this whole process from start to finish and come out on top. So, you know, as when you talk to the experts, that's what they say some of this derives from. But to me, again, you know, I can't even watch sort of the ultimate fighting kind of stuff, so I don't know how people, you know, where the joy is in this stuff.
It must have been hard for you to even write some of what's in the book because of the descriptions of what happened to the dogs and their injuries. It's hard just as a human being to think about the pain that they went through.
Yeah, it brings us to some bad places, that's for sure. For me, it was harder, you know, during the research, you go on some of these websites and you just see some of the photos and, you know, and even there's videos, and I can't watch those, you know, but it's, that was harder. The writing of it, once, sort of a little bit, once you go into the mode where you're writing, you just get caught up in telling the story and you don't sort of internalize it in a sense, you know?
Right.
So that wasn't as bad for me, but I know that that has been, you know, a lot of the feedback so far. Some people have a little bit of a hard time with that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you want it to be realistic and you want it to be sort of an unblinking look at the reality of
exactly
what goes on.
Right. And tell me why you think Michael Vick would have been attracted to doing this. He was making lots and lots of money. He's, you know, this famous football star. And why, and you include his upbringing, which I think is interesting to know about him. But why do this? He didn't have to do this.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, and I didn't want to, you know, just like blindly paint him as some sort of, you know, sociopath or something. You know, that's why I did want to go into his background. And you know, he grew up in a very difficult setting, basically a project, very low income, a lot of poverty and drugs. And you know, he saw his first dogfights when he was 7 or 8 years old. And when you look at the studies about dogfights, one of the things they say, one of the most damaging things about it, is that it desensitizes people to violence. People who go to these things and watch them become not only desensitized to violence between dogs or among animals, but to all types of it. There's higher rates of domestic abuse amongst people who participate in this. So you're looking at a kid now, 7 or 8 years old. He's witnessing dogfights on a regular basis, you know, outside his window. You know, it probably desensitizes to you. He's just coming, you know, from a totally different place, values-wise, than a lot of, you know, mainstream America. And so that's how he winds up in it. You know, that's not to excuse where he winds up. You know, I think at some point when you're 25 years old and you have a $130 million contract,
right,
and you're regularly dealing with corporate America, you know, at some point the light has to go on and say, you know what, this is not good. This is not something I should be doing anymore, and you have to walk away from it. You know, he did the opposite. I mean, he pursued this. He was an active participant.
Yeah. Tell me just briefly, we're going to meet one of the adoptive owners of one of the dogs in a moment here, and we'll weave much more of the story. But tell me about the heroes in this story, because not everybody was heroic. There were a lot of people who wanted to protect their turf. There were people who wanted to protect Michael Vick. Who made sure that this story got out?
You know, one of the amazing things about it, as you got into the story and into the lost dogs, is how many heroes there were. You know, people like to ask me, you know, will it be a movie? And I say, you know what, I don't think so, because there's just too many characters. There's too many heroes. There's too many stories to tell. But, yeah, it starts with the initial investigators. You know, Bill Brinkman, the local deputy, assistant deputy, and Jim Knorr, the USDA investigator, and then went to the prosecutor's office. Mike Gill did some, not only a great job with the case, but some really unprecedented things, and considered the option of sparing the dogs. And then you go on to the SPCA, who got involved in helping evaluate. Then there's, I mean, countless people, rescuers, and then the foster homes and the people who actually took these dogs in and took on the task, the very difficult daily grinding task of trying to rehabilitate and retrain them and give these dogs, you know, a good life.
Right.
And so it's a long list, and that's one of the things that, you know, in reading it, in reading the book, I think that really comes through is just how many people, how much dedication and how much compassion from how many people was necessary to make this happen.
And how many dogs were able to be rescued?
They took 51 pit bulls off the property initially. Two died in government custody. After the evaluations, two were euthanized, one because it was injured and suffering, and one because it sort of had mentally reached a place where it was not reachable anymore and was suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other 47 were all placed.
Isn't that remarkable? 47 were placed.
Yeah, I mean, the experts went in hoping to get, you know, maybe five, and they did far better.
Yeah, we'll meet one of the owners. We wish we could talk with the dog, but we can talk with the dog through the eyes and ears of Brandon Bond, adopter of Machiavelli Mac, one of the rescued dogs. And we'll take your phone calls, too. Jim Gorant is with us, senior editor, Sports Illustrated, author of The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption, which has just been published. And Jim wrote the cover piece. And evidently that story got more emails and phone calls than just about anything that was published by Sports Illustrated that year. It's much, much further investigation from the piece that he did when the story broke. Here is our phone number if you'd like to join our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address for us, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're inviting you to join us for a lovely fall outing on October 21st. We'll have a live broadcast at the gorgeous Milwaukee Art Museum. Nancy Pearl is going to be in town, and she, of course, is the author of the best-selling Booklust series. She has been our guest regularly for many years now when each of her books comes out, and then some. She has a phenomenal history of books. She's read so much, and she remembers what she reads and has great suggestions for all kinds of tastes for children and adults. The other hour of the program, she'll be with us 1 hour, and then Lori Winters will join us as well. She is the museum director of exhibits and has brought some top-notch exhibits to the Milwaukee Art Museum. So this is a live broadcast. If you can come, please let us know, because we'd like to reserve your brownie and coffee for you. We want to know how many people are coming. You know, have a rough idea. So if you could email Rhonda at Fanning, F-A-N-N-I-N-G, at WPR.org, or we invite you to go to our Facebook page, too, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'd love to see you there. It is a beautiful place. We're going to talk about books and art and then eat and talk, and it will be a good old time. Joining our conversation now with Jim Gorant, senior editor of Sports Illustrated, author of The Lost Dogs, is Brandon Bond. And Brandon is the owner now, the adopter of Machiavelli, one of three dogs, Vic dogs, that were signed over to a partnership of the Georgia SPCA and All or Nothing Rescue, which is run by tattoo artist Brandon Bond. He's an experienced rescuer. He's been saving dogs since he witnessed a fight. We'll ask him to talk about that in a moment. This is when he was very young. Shortly after he started All or Nothing in Georgia, the organization has saved more than 400 dogs. And we thank you so much, Brandon, for joining us for part of our show today. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Brandon. Thanks so much for being with us. Tell me about when you witnessed that dog fight. You were just a teenager in Texas, right? And it made a huge impression on you.
Yes, ma'am. It was a mind-blowing experience, and definitely one I care not to revisit, for sure. But really, it inspired a kind of a lifelong adventure of good things. So It worked out.
Yeah. So did you see the Michael Vick story on television and immediately want to rescue one of these dogs? Or how did Machiavelli come to you?
You know, it's kind of an interesting story because, obviously, in Atlanta, the story was larger than anywhere else because that's where Vic was a quarterback. And as soon as the case broke, it dominated every channel for several days. But as soon as I saw it, I leaned over and I told my wife, we were watching television, I told her, we're getting some of these dogs.
We have to get
some of these dogs. And of course, normally when something like this happens, the dogs are euthanized when they're no longer good as evidence. So she didn't believe me. And I said, no, I think that we can get them. And the truth is, I knew somebody would get caught eventually, a high-profile person, either a musician or an athlete. Somebody was going to get caught, and I saw it as an opportunity to act. And it worked out great. They didn't euthanize him. Hallelujah.
And tell me about Mac.
Mac is the most amazing dog ever. He still struggles a lot, though. Machiavelli was, and that was the reason that we selected him to foster and eventually adopt, because he seemed to be the most afraid of all of them. He's never had any animal aggression, no people aggression, but he's just scared.
Aww.
So it took a long time for him to even, like, trust people to give him food. It's not that he was in any way aggressive ever. I've never seen it once in a couple years now, but he was just deathly afraid. Like, if you open a soda can near him, he would run and hide under the bed. Like, every little sound was like a war zone in his head. It was sad. But now he's much better, and he loves the other dogs. He lives with five other rescued animals, and he's inseparable with his girlfriend named Annie Oakley.
That's a great name.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We were already filming the rescue of Annie Oakley, his girlfriend, before the Vic case broke, so it actually made our film like a much more dynamic experience. We were just working with her, and she was incredibly emaciated, neglected. She wasn't a fighting dog. She was just nobody fed her and dumped her somewhere. And so all that was happening in the background of the film. Like, when the news broke, you can actually see it on the news in the background.
Oh.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Good timing.
Yeah, yeah, remarkable timing. And Jim, these dogs were all tested. If you outline that process pretty thoroughly in the book to make sure that they could be adopted, they were looked at very, very carefully.
Yeah, the ASPCA sort of put together this expert team, and they went in and they had a whole series of tests that they did, to try and just ascertain the dog's disposition. And then they put them into, it's like four different categories based on what they thought the potential was. Some of them, like Mac, most of them, the most common thing was what Brandon saw with Mac, just this sort of skittishness and fear. They were very uncertain of themselves. Anytime they were approached or anything new came near them, they just basically either tried to shut down, lay flat on the ground, or the tails down, head down, very sort of twitchy. And so for most of them, what they were dealing with was this fear. And then they were placed following that according to what, the team thought their potential was or thought their immediate needs were. I mean, I think they felt the potential for almost all of them eventually, could be adoption, but they thought some would need more help than others. And, some had a minimum of a six-month period of observation in a foster home with experienced dog handlers. Some had to go to a sanctuary where they have to go at least a year of observation. But, all the dogs were given sort of a prescription based on how they performed in these tests.
What does this tell us? What is this story of redemption? And I'd like to hear both of you talk about this. I know you've rescued a number of dogs, Brandon, so maybe we should start with you. A dog who has been abused, maybe even a dog who's been a fighter, can become a dog who's really a wonderful pet and maybe even a therapy dog. What does it tell us about this breed and our perceptions of dogs that we think are bad dogs? Brandon?
Well, what I've found is that there is no dog on earth that is more astute, intelligent, loyal, protective than a pit bull. Gratitude is the number one overwhelming sense that I get from rescued animals, in the sense that, like, I have one dog that's not a rescue. It just happened to end up with us, and it's spoiled rotten, whereas all the rescue dogs, every time you give them a bowl of food, it's almost like Christmas Day to them.
It's
like they won the lottery twice a day. It's spectacular. Wouldn't trade it for anything.
Oh.
And I don't think that dogs, have that sense unless they've gone without. So as sad as it is, it actually ends up making it like they're opening presents constantly. Mm. So it's a good experience.
Yeah, Jim?
Yeah, I don't have the first-hand experience, but one of the things when, there's the original magazine story, but when it came time to write The Lost Dogs, one of the great things that I felt about that was it was a chance to really get into all that stuff about pit bulls, the history of the breed.
Right.
Where they came from, how they developed, and why they've gotten sort of unfairly this bad reputation, and really sort of trying to expose what these dogs are really about, and how that, if they're socialized and raised properly and treated properly, they can be the sweetest, loving dogs as anything else out there. And for some reason, that's just a message that hasn't gotten out to most of America, but hopefully this will help, start turning the tide.
Yeah. Let's take one call at least while you're with us, Brandon. Ron in Viroqua. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I inherited a Bertonshire Bull Terrier, a.k.a. Pit Bull. And my partner at the time had moved into a townhouse, and she couldn't have the dog, so she asked if I could take her. Well, I lived with my 91-year-old mother at the time, and my family was strictly against it, but Ninja Rosie was her name, and she had her tail. She was picked up as a puppy, raised with nothing but love. And my partner brought her over to the house one day when the family was there, and we were sitting in the backyard, and Ninja just went right to my mother, put her head on her lap.
Aww.
And it was a match made in heaven.
Aww.
And it's kind of hard. But from that day on, she stayed with her. I mean, she would sit, she would lay by her side. My mother started to fail in health, and Ninja was just at her, with her all the time.
Mm.
And then Ninja Rosie became ill, and we had to put her down in January this year. And a month later, my mother passed away.
Aww.
But She was by far the most fantastic dog I had ever owned or known in my whole life.
Mm.
Love, I mean, that's all she knew was love, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to make that comment.
Oh, I'm so glad you did, Ron. Thanks for the call.
People have such a twisted idea about a pit bull. I mean, all the stories that my family heard were all the bad ones.
Right.
When they met Ninja, they just fell in love with her.
So. Thank you so much for your call. Jim, we do have that image of pit bulls. What a story. It's making me cry.
Yeah, that's the thing. Once you start scratching below, like the surface of pit bulls, the wall that you meet when you start the topic is all the bad stuff. But once you start poking behind that at all, you hear these kinds of stories over and over again about, you know, people have these experiences, just not of just being great dogs, but even beyond that. Like, you know, there's so many people I get these emails and notes from, I'll never own another type of dog than a pit bull. And, you know, it's out there everywhere. So it's sort of amazing that, you know, it takes a little bit of looking, but once you look, you'll find, you know, something totally opposite to what the general presumption is.
Yeah. Brandon, I'm sure you have some stories.
Definitely. Ron's story actually is just like Jim said, amazingly common. You know, pit bulls were originally like the family dog that in this country. Like when the man would leave the ranch or whatever, the dog would herd and watch the children. It's unfortunately part of the reason that they have been exploited. If you look at, and unfortunately I had to go through thousands of hours of stock dogfighting footage to make my film. But the overwhelming constant that you always see is there's always a handler inside the ring, and the dogs are doing their best to impress the handler. They're basically willing to die because they're so loyal to the monster on the other end of the leash. And that is horrifying to me. But I am one of those people. I will never own another dog other than a pit bull.
Really?
They are by far the most loyal and amazing animals in the world. And so many people, we get hundreds of letters every week from people that adopted a dog and had a very similar experience to what Ron just said. It's beautiful, and it's unfortunate that the media, you know, it's just shock value, like pit bull attack, you know. Labrador retrievers don't sell commercials very good, I guess.
Yeah.
What
about this? Why are there then, Jim? Let me go to you on this. So many pit bulls that are fighting dogs. Not so many. I mean, but there are. That seems to be the breed, at least that we hear about, that does fighting, and it's also the breed that people seem to buy. I live in the city of Milwaukee, and I do notice a lot of pit bulls and, you know, kind of tough-looking guys who are walking their pit bulls. You don't see diminutive young people or too many kids walking pit bulls. And I think that they're making a statement when they're walking these dogs that I got a tough dog and I'm tough too. What's that all about?
Well, I mean, I think one of the biggest things is like what Brandon said, they have certain attributes that can be then used against them to make them good. I mean, they're athletic. You know, they are very dedicated and very determined, you know. So when you put them to a task, they will do it, you know, over and over, and they work really hard at it. And so that then their eagerness to please, that can all be turned against them. But I also think that I just lost my train of thought.
That's all right.
Mostly, you know, it's that they can be misused, and that's very unfortunate.
Isn't that astounding that they will do anything to impress their handler, including dying for the handler? What Brandon just said?
Yeah, I mean, that's the level of attachment they have, you know, and it's both impressive, you know, and unfortunate.
Yeah. Hmm. Do you want to respond to that whole conversation, Brandon?
Excuse me?
Do you want to respond to what we were saying about, you know, tough guys walking around with their pit bulls? And
well, you know, I am a tough guy. My whole body's tattooed. We're tattoo artists in Atlanta.
You're a tough guy, huh?
Yeah, I see it constantly. Unfortunately, that's why so many of the shelters are flooded with them, because, you know, big macho guys or whatever buy the dog thinking, wow, I'm going to get the biggest, meanest, coolest guard dog ever. But pit bulls are not and have never been human aggressive. It's not part of their breeding or their genetics. They're exploited for their animal aggression that is trained in them by the bad people, but they aren't human aggressive. So what happens is people buy this guard dog. It doesn't guard anything. It just licks you when you walk in. And then they dump the dog.
And end up getting
some other kind of dog. So then here we go with another 10 million dogs because they weren't as aggressive as they look. They are very strong dogs, and I think that has a lot to do with why they're used in fighting, just because they're little tanks, you know, and they'll do anything for their owner. So they are perfect for that if you're, you know, twisted weirdo. But ironically, if you look back at, like, all the 80s movies and stuff, it was always Dobermans. You know, and then it was Rottweilers.
Right.
Now it's pit bulls. I think it's almost just a trendy kind of what's the worst dog of this decade? Well, right now we're in the middle of the pit bull situation, and we're just doing everything we can to help dispel that.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking a lot about tattoos lately. We have to have you on another show about why everybody's getting tattoos. But that's another subject. All right, let's do it. We'll do that. Let's go to Bonnie and Madison, and then we'll switch guests here. Hi, Bonnie.
Well, hi, Kathleen. Well, thanks for having this show. I think I like to make a statement, too, when I walk my pit bull because I'm a grandmother and I'm retired. And so I think maybe if more older people got pit bulls, it might take away from some of the mystique.
Right.
I'd like to ask the guests maybe to expand just a little bit more on the personality of the pit bull, because I think they're basically a combination of the two dogs they've been bred from, which is they're sweet like bulldogs, but they're very energetic like terriers. And I think that's another reason a lot of them wind up in pounds, because they're so energetic. And I think mine is digging a hole to China in the backyard.
And how did you happen to get him, Bonnie?
Well, I just saw it on the internet on Pet Finder, and she was in a high-kill shelter about ready to be gassed.
Oh.
So I sent an application, but mine is just adorable.
Oh.
They're not big. They're only like about, they're medium-sized dogs, and she sits in my lap and tries to sit in my lap and then puts her face right against mine when I'm sitting on the couch.
Oh, I love these stories. Jim, do you want to, thank you so much, Bonnie, for calling. Jim?
Well, yeah, I mean, part of the response to that is and what was really sort of groundbreaking about this case and one of what we get into in The Lost Dogs is that, you know, you can't, in a way, make those generalizations. Yeah, you can say some general things there, the bulldog and the terrier, so they have sort of a drive working thing, but the big, sweet dog. But what they did here that was really radical is that instead of saying, there's a group of fighting dogs, fighting pit bulls, we should kill them all, they said, you know what? Let's take this group of dogs and look at them all individually and figure out if there are any of them that we can save. And that was that's the kind of thing that was never done before. And so this ASPCA team came in and they looked at each dog individually. And sure enough, out of the 51, they saved 47. And as you go forward, that's sort of a theme that continues. You know, at this point, you can't look back and say the Vic dogs are this or the Vic dogs are that. You have to say, you know, Machiavelli is this, Jasmine is that. You know, they're all individuals now, and that's really what has saved them and brought them to this point. And so you have to sort of carry that through and say, yeah, okay, there's some general things you can say about the breed one way or the other, but really it's dog by dog, and you have to, whether it's a poodle or whether it's a chihuahua or whether it's a pit bull, you have to look at them all separately and say, who's this dog and what's he all about? And so as much as there are some really great general things about the pit bull, you know, more so I think the idea that, you know, forget the breed, look at the dog is a bigger message.
Yeah. Thank you, Bonnie, so much. If you have access to Facebook, we'd love to see your dog, too. If you can post a picture, that would be... This is a day to post dog pictures. You should do that if you can. Brandon, thank you so much for being with us. And we'll be in touch with you to talk about tattoos, if you don't mind.
Bring it on. I'd love to send you a copy of our documentary as well.
So oh, great.
Sure,
okay.
You guys get one of those. It's easy. It's just VicDogMovie.com, and we're donating all the money to saving more of them. So,
what, Vic Dog Movie?
VicDogMovie.com.
.com. All right. Thank you, Brandon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. The other thing, to go back to the rescue here, Jim, is that this had to be done extremely carefully because, of course, all eyes would be on this case. And thanks to you, all eyes are on this dog. And so these dogs, so they had to be very, very carefully screened because you didn't want bad things to happen.
Right, not only in terms of screening the dogs beforehand, but then also screening where they went. I mean, they were very careful about, you know, who got the dogs and what sort of commitment they could make and capability they had to care for them and keep them out of situations where problems would arise. I mean, that's half the battle is knowing what the troublesome situations are and avoiding them. So there was a lot of time and effort and energy that went into all of that.
Right. Frank from Madison is next. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Splendid program.
Thanks, Frank.
Two splendid guests. Brandon sounds very interesting, and your author is bringing something up that the late Vicki Hearn treated in a book of hers about called Bandit, about a bull terrier of the same name who bit his master, whose circumstances were unfortunate. And so he was a vicious dog and was to be put down. And Ms. Hearn was a veterinarian and an animal behavioralist, and she testified at a hearing, because the master tested that the dog would be put down, that it wasn't actually vicious and that it could be saved. And the court said, prove it. The dog's yours. And after a given length of time, if it's still likely to bite, it's to be put down. And so Vicki Hearn ended up with the dog, not the master. And the dog was very gentle, intelligent, good member of the community. But her university colleagues were always disturbed at the appearance of Bandit. But so she looked at the circumstance of what people's expectations are and what happens when you change the circumstances. And so your author is doing the same thing. What happens when expectations are confounded, both about dogs and people? So thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Jim?
Yeah.
Do you want to respond to it?
Sure. No, I think it sounds like it's more of the same. You know, I hadn't heard that particular story. And also, I don't, you know, one of the things we want to be careful of is we don't want to give the impression that, hey, you could just take some fighting dogs, and, you know, fighting dogs you come across, and just give them a nice home and some love, and they're going to be great. I mean, more goes into it than that, and it's a complex topic. And like I say, there was a lot of precautions taken about where these dogs went and what sort of treatment they received. So, you know, there is that aspect of it. But by and large, the idea that, you know, pit bulls as a breed are bad dogs, or that, you know, all dogs from this situation just need to be sort of summarily done away with, that's an idea that's been challenged. And I think the result has been pretty widely accepted that things need to change. And, in fact, in the wake of the Michael Vick case, the Humane Society changed their official position, whereas previously they had recommended euthanization. Now they recommend this idea of individual evaluation and attempting to place dogs that seem worthy of it.
What about this consideration when it comes to pit bulls? I know that people breed dogs that you can look for dogs to be mom and dads who are kind of gentle and laid back, or dogs that are more playful or more guard dogs. Do you run a risk with pit bulls that some of them have been bred for their fighting qualities?
I don't know that you run a risk. I mean, certainly that probably exists, but you know, one of the things in the Lost Dogs, sort of in the same vein that we dug into a little bit, is how successful that is. And there's a famous line of pit bulls called Colby dogs, and they bred fighting dogs for years, and some people in the family were arrested for that, and now they continue to breed their line of dogs, but now they say they breed them, you know, to be great family dogs. They're no longer attached to the fight business, but sort of the patriarch of the family had once been quoted as saying that, you know, if you take your two best fighting dogs, male and female, and you breed them, and you get a litter of 12 pups, you get maybe one champion out of that group. So even if you're breeding your two best fighters, I mean, that sort of speaks to, you know, how hard it is to make these dogs do this, and how sort of rare they are to get a dog that reacts that way. And another thing that Brandon sort of hinted at before is that even whatever aggression pit bulls have, it's mostly directed at other animals. You know, that's that sort of terrier instinct.
Yes.
There are people in the pit with the dogs when they fight. So any dogs that showed any tendency to be aggressive toward people, were not bred. They were not, that line was not continued. So pit bulls are one of the most responsive dogs to people out there. And if there's any aggression issue, it's usually aggression towards other animals.
Oh, interesting.
But like I say, you know, just fighting breeding dogs isn't going to make a dog a fighter.
Right. Thank you for the information. More phone calls in a moment. Jim Gorant is our guest, one of our guests. We've been joined by people who have adopted some of these dogs from the Vic Farm. He is senior editor, Sports Illustrated. He's the author of The Lost Dogs, Michael Vick's Dogs and Their Tale of Rescue and Redemption. Martina McClay, who adopted Leo, will be with us in a moment, originally called Bouncer because of his tendency to continuously jump around. He was originally considered the luckiest of the Vic dogs because he was the only one sent to the shelter in Hopewell, Virginia, which was smaller and quieter, and he was treated as an individual. We'll talk about how Martina found who was then called Bouncer, now Leo, in just a moment as we speak with her. And welcome more phone calls. The number, we'll have time for a few more calls, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we meet Martina, let me ask you this from a listener who has sent an email, Jim. I'm curious, with your perspective in the horrible lives these dogs lived before being rescued, how do you feel about seeing Michael Vick being allowed back into the NFL and so far getting a lot of playing time for the Philadelphia Eagles? In fact, Vick was the starting quarterback this week for the Eagles.
How do I feel about that? I mean, my first instinct is to feel that there's a criminal justice system. The guy was given a sentence. He served his time. You know, he's been forced to declare bankruptcy as a result of all this, and so it seems senseless to deny the right to make a living at this point. You know, I know he has done work with the Humane Society, and I hope he continues to do that, and I hope he'll use whatever sort of spotlight, you know, he attains at this point to try and help spread the message and fix the problem. But, you know, no one can control that except for him. You know, he did bad things, and you hate to see somebody seemingly rewarded for that, but I'm not sure that's the situation right now.
Mm-hmm. Joining our conversation, Martina McClay, who adopted Leo, who used to be called Bouncer. Martina, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Where do you live?
Los Gatos, California.
California. Woo! How did Bouncer / Leo get all the way to California, Martina?
Well, he was driven out here by Nicole Rete, who I think was back there working with some of the dogs early on.
And how did he come to your attention?
I had seen something on CNN. There was a news clip, which I haven't seen since then, but there was a news clip that looked like an animal control officer was, you know, holding a leash with a gorgeous dog at the end of it. And there was this news flash that Michael Vick had been arrested on charges of dog fighting. And I just, you know, looked at this news clip and I was like, wow, I can't believe this. And started thinking, you know, well, I know what happens in many of these cases, you know, hopefully, you know, I kind of hope that, you know, the dogs would be able to live and go on and leave some, you know, good lives. And I had mentioned to someone sitting next to me that, you know, it'd be great to take some of these dogs and make them therapy dogs. And that is what happened.
You've made your dog a therapy dog. Isn't that something?
Yeah. Well, he made himself a therapy dog, too. It's something he really likes to do. I heard Jim making the point earlier that these dogs are very responsive to humans. It only took me 5 weeks.
Really?
To train him. Yeah.
Oh.
I got him in December 16th, 2007, and January 23rd, he was registered with Therapy Dogs Incorporated. And he, you know, the training, I mean, there was, like you said, he was a bouncer. I mean, he bounced literally all over the place like a giant puppy, and he did need training, there's no question, and I worked really hard on that part and very intensive, and but the therapy part is the work that he does is more of a reward for him, like the work itself. Like, I don't need to bring treats and food and things like that to, you know, bait him into, you know, doing the work. He's happy when he walks in and sees the cancer patients that he works with. he just walks in and puts his head on their lap. And, you know, he's just like, wow, this is the best job in the world.
Oh.
This is just all I want to do. It's awesome.
Oh, isn't it astounding, Jim, that you could train this dog in 5 weeks?
Yeah, Leo was sort of one of the, you know, one of the really remarkable stories to come out of the book. And he's one of, you know, in The Lost Dogs, I sort of focused on about 5 of the dogs and traced their sort of path once they got out of the shelters. And Leo was one of them because it was just, the story was so sort of remarkable. There was no way not to include it. And, you know, it was interesting, like, Martin says, you know, he'll go in and put his head on people's laps, and it just reminded me of the caller earlier who said his dog did the same thing with his mother, who was ailing at the time, and that immediately made me think of Martina and Leo, because she says he'll often do that when he goes into these hospitals and homes and stuff, and he can sort of sense people. She has told me these stories about, seems to be able to tell who's sicker than whom and who reacts accordingly, and it's really sort of an amazing thing.
Yeah, he does. He can really tell when, you know, I can look at his body language and what he's doing, and I can look at the patient and see why he's responding the way he's responding. It's really quite fascinating, and it's very rewarding work. What's awesome about it, too, is that, you know, here Leo came from where he came from, and we not only get to help, you know, because we have our rescue, RPAC, and we not only get to help dogs that come from these situations. We've worked on cases like this since then, and we've found this to be a repetitive thing. Dogs that come from these cases do like to be therapy dogs. And I'm not saying that there aren't dogs and from some of these cases that are very damaged and so forth. I'm not just saying,
right,
you know, we can just take the dogs and we don't have to ever do anything and we can just plop them down in a home and do absolutely nothing. I want to make that clear. But we have found that this is just something that they really like to do. And what's awesome about it is we get to help dogs, and then we also get to help people. And this, you know, it helps the breed, it helps the dogs, it helps people who are sick and not feeling well. You know, from what I hear, it's not fun receiving chemotherapy. It's not a fun thing to be doing.
Yes. Yeah, dogs can be amazingly comforting. Jim from mm-hmm. Antigo. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I think the whole tragedy of this whole story is that Michael Vick's back out on the street. I mean, if you get online, this is the only reason this got publicized is because of who he was. I mean, if you get online, there is thousands of cases worse than this one.
Jim?
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, and you know, in an odd way, you know, Michael Vick's sort of the best thing that happened to the pit bulls, because he brought all this notoriety. I mean, if this is not Michael Vick's involvement, your initial Sports Illustrated article never happens, this book never happens, all these discussions, you know, about the raising of a level of awareness of what's going on and how much dog finding is out there, and also the opportunity to sort of get to the heart of what pit bulls are really about. All this that's going on never happens without him in an odd way. It's sort of helped, you know, and whether he's out on the street or not. I mean, it's hopefully the impact, and that could be a point going forward that could be a turning point maybe for these dogs, you know, because it is bringing more attention than there ever has been before and telling a different story than has been told in the past.
Mm-hmm. Gene and Amory. Hi, Gene. Are you there, Gene? Boyd is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi,
Boyd. I love your guests. This is a great show. I actually, within a couple months, and I just met him the other day, I'm going to be house-sitting for a friend of mine who's going to Arizona, and he has a new dog, and his name is Petey, named after the dog in The Little Rascals. And he told me that of all the people Petey has met, he's taken to me the best, and Petey is a very, very wonderful dog. My question is, though, you know, I see a lot of abuse, not just with pit bulls, but with, you know, a lot of household pets in general. And, you know, whenever I see a vicious dog, regardless of the breed, my mind is always rushing to, well, who is the owner? What are they doing?
Yeah.
And is there any way that, you know, law enforcement can, if anything, step in and find just people who just in general abuse their animals? They may not be, you know, putting them in underground fighting, but just whether, you know, some type of physical abuse or something like that. I mean, obviously.
Okay, Martina, we'll go to you on that. We have about 30 seconds, 35.
good point. You know, dogs don't have to come from a fighting ring to have to be neglected or abused or, you know, under-socialized. The best thing to do if you see something that doesn't look right, a dog that's chained up day in, day out, left in the backyard day in, day out, the best thing you can do, there's different ordinances for different areas, is to call animal control and report it if you think something is amiss. And they should be able to come out and, you know, help you. Provide education, get handouts from, you know, websites that have appropriate information. You know, you can also volunteer for your local shelter, do lectures and talks, and do whatever you can to get the awareness out there.
Okay. Jim, thank you so much for writing this book. It's just, it's a very good book, and change will change a lot of dogs' lives and people's lives, too. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. And Martina, we thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thank you
so much. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this very interesting hour. The only thing we were missing were a few dogs here, but that's okay. They spoke through their owners. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Randall Davidson will be with us during tomorrow's 10 o'clock hour. We celebrate the anniversary of the Ideas Network, and he wrote a great history. So that's coming up tomorrow.